To me, to talk about today is the topic of changing ourselves, change. I think all spiritual practice involves some kind of change, involves wanting some kind of change, to go from a state of suffering to a state of without suffering or a state of ease, to go from agitation to calm, or to go from a closed heart to an open, compassionate heart. There's usually something people want, some kind of change that people want when they first come to a spiritual practice. In some practices, in some Buddhist practices, then as they go along, they learn they're not supposed to want to have any change, that the spiritual practice itself is just to accept things as they are. So then the change is they want to go from the state of not accepting things to accepting things. That's the change they want. So it gets more subtle. But still, there's some kind of change that people want to have. And so what is our relationship to wanting to change ourselves or change things around us? How do we do this? How do we change ourselves in a healthy way? This morning I talked about practicing according to the Dharma, or practicing according to nature, practicing according to the truth. I'm paying a little bit more attention than I have before to children, as some of you might surmise, know. And it seems to me that little children, are sometimes wonderful saints, full of openness and presence, and sometimes they seem, whatever the opposite of a saint is, you know, I mean, they're angry and whining. Like my little son, he knows how to complain. I mean, express frustration. You know, if he can't get my book out of my bookcase, because I've wedged all the books in really tight so that he can't pull them out, because I don't want my books all over the floor. But so he'll go and try to pull a book out, and it's like you know, the most awful thing has happened to him. It possibly could have happened to him. He's tremendous frustration and upset, and he's yelling and screaming, and I just feel terrible. What have I done to my son? Just that the books are wedged in there, you can't pull them out. What a big deal. But, you know, he expresses all this frustration. But what strikes me about my son, about many children, is a lot of their emotions are often right there on the surface. It's really clear where they're at. You know, and if my son doesn't like something, it's really clear he doesn't want it. You know, he makes it obvious he doesn't want it. There's no doubting what he wants and what he doesn't want. It's really right there on the surface. And then somehow as we grow up, as we get older, we start developing the ability to have more reason, live more in the world of ideas, concepts, abstractions. And with that seems to come the ability to have a disjunction between what we express to the world and what's going on inside. That it's possible to feel angry inside, but no one looking at you realize you're angry. We can actually express a different emotions and feelings than what we're really going on inside. And our surface isn't necessarily honestly expressing what's inside in the way it is for children. Sometimes people who are drunk can be extremely honest that way. I don't know, I'm not recommending it, but certain people who have or various people in a kind of extreme circumstances, where there's extreme circumstances of mental situations or whatever, sometimes are very sensitive and to the issue of the dissonance between the inside and the outside. But I think as we become older, there isn't necessarily, we're not necessarily always so honest in expressing what we feel on the inside. And occasionally, this distance is so great that we don't even know what we're feeling on the inside. But sometimes we do know what we're feeling, and we're not being honest about it, we're not expressing it. So somehow we go from the state as a child where we have this openness and this freedom of expression to later we become more inhibited or more manipulative or more cunning in our use of abstractions, abstract expressions, and our ideals of shoulds and shouldn'ts. But when I think about, you know, my son or children, they just express what's inside of them, kind of flows out seemingly somewhat naturally, easily for him. I think of the form of a change or development that maybe it's a little bit idealistic, but of a flower. A flower just kind of, you know, you don't go to, a gardener doesn't go out in the garden and start pulling up, open the petals in order to have an open flower. Or you don't tug at the sprout, the seed that's sprouting up through the ground, try to get it to grow faster. You kind of allow the flower to kind of unfold by itself, naturally by itself. It'll, with time, the flower will unfold. If all the conditions are right, the flower will just unfold on its own. You don't have to do anything. If you're tired or stressed out, oftentimes if you just go lay down in a nice quiet place, your body knows what to do to give yourself the rest that you need, oftentimes. The body has a tremendous amount of understanding of how to take care of itself that your mind could never possibly figure out or control or cope with. If the mind had to figure out and be on top of and be tracking and the pumping of the heart and circulating all the blood and getting the immune system going and fighting this bug and that bug, and it's just a phenomenal amount of stuff that the body's doing without us being consciously aware and thinking about it and organizing and manipulating and wanting to have that kind of change happening. There is this kind of natural processing of nature that happens aside from whether we want it to or not, or whether our mind is consciously involved in the change. And then there's a change that we do because the mind is aware of the need for change or wants to have change, and then it imposes change on the environment and on ourselves. And that can be a whole range of ways we want to do it. But oftentimes, it's not necessarily an expression of a natural unfolding, but rather it can become an imposition of our ego, of our fear, of our hostility, or of our ambition. We have all these abstract ideas as we get older and become more sophisticated in our minds. And as we start living more in the world of ideas, then we often impose the ideas on top of whatever is the natural unfolding expression of who we are. And I keep saying, you know, the busier we become often, the more we tend to live in the world of ideas. And the more we live in the world of ideas, the more likely we are then to impose our ideas on top of nature rather than being patient and allowing nature to show itself what needs to happen, what we need to open for. So how is it we go about changing ourselves? And one of the issues is, do we change ourselves in accord with the laws of nature, in accord with nature, or do we do it against nature, kind of fighting nature or being hostile to nature, imposing something, resisting nature, resisting what's going on. It's interesting to me for in this theme that, you know, in some spiritual circles they talk about, you know, enlightenment, and they talk about getting away, the path to enlightenment is going up a mountain. You've heard that, right? I don't know where it all began, that idea of the mountain as the image. But, you know, you climb the mountain and, you know, it's hard work to climb a mountain. You know, some people are more fit than others, so it's not as hard, but some mountains are steeper than others, so then it's hard again. And whatever, it takes effort and energy to climb a mountain. The image that the Buddha used I don't know anywhere where the Buddha used the image of climbing a mountain for the path to enlightenment. The Buddha used the image of a river, that if you engage in practice with some degree of faith or trust or conviction, if you engage in practice with engagement, with some effort and energy, kind of to wake up and pay attention, to be attentive, if you are mindful, if you try to be attentive to what's actually happening here, if you do that with some steadiness, some kind of continuity through time, and with some wisdom, some understanding, some insight in what's actually happening here, that it's not a matter of climbing a mountain. If you do those things, then you enter into the stream, into the river, and the river will carry you into the ocean. Supposedly all rivers in India, at least, I guess, end up in the ocean. And all you have to do is kind of get in the, you know, kind of get in the river, and it'll just carry you along. So the image is more of being carried by gravity in the flow of the water down to awakening. And that's a very different feeling. To me, it's a much more restful feeling than climbing a mountain, which, you know. It also lends itself to a less ego-driven notion of the path, the spiritual path. I think the idea of climbing a mountain and getting to be the first one, only one person can, mountains kind of, usually mountains have kind of a little peak, right, a little summit. You know, at least the ideal mountain has a little summit, but only one person can stand on it at a time. You know, so it's great, you know, I'm going to be the one king of the mountain. But the ocean, you know, ocean's big enough, everybody can coexist in the ocean. The ocean's big enough for everyone. So I kind of like this image. And so practice is kind of like more like being like water than it is like being a mountain climber. And water has this wonderful feeling of kind of, water kind of goes, water doesn't resist anything, they say. Water kind of just flows with the gravity and finds its own way and around things rather than kind of busting through things usually. So in wanting to change ourselves, which I'm assuming that everyone here today wants to change themselves in some way. I don't think we come to a spiritual practice, we don't come to a retreat like this unless we desire some kind of change, even with our best intentions to just to accept things as they are. Even that involves, you know, trying to do something. So the question is, if that's true, if my assumption is true, that all of you are here because you want some kind of change, do you know what that change is? That you, how you want to change yourself? And what is your attitude? How are you trying to do that? And you're trying to change yourself in accord with nature, with the Dharma, with truth, or you're doing it as an imposition, imposing some idea, some abstractions that is that involves resisting, involves maybe some kind of hardness, or involves some kind of working against nature, against yourself, against what's deeply true. And that's the question. You know, that I can't answer that for you, but that's, I think, a very useful investigation. Is to look, you know, in wanting to change myself, how am I going about it? Now, to do it more in line with nature, I think, my belief, my understanding, is more to see how can I allow what's the natural unfolding to happen more freely by itself. And what that requires is mindfulness, patience, investigation, really studying what's really going on here. What is a change I want? What is a situation I find myself in? What stands in the way of change? And really using our ability to investigate, to be mindful, to discover, rather than to force some kind of change, you know, to kind of strong arm the situation. So it requires mindfulness, awareness, attentiveness, to discover what is really here, what is really true with me, and what's really true here. And paying attention, not so much, and paying attention in such a way, or with the question, what is it that needs to happen? Not what is it I need to do? And there's a difference between those two questions. What needs to happen here? Not what do I need to do? What do I need to get out of the way for so it's going to move through me? I believe that if we leave ourselves alone, if we pay attention and get out of the way, that just like the flower opens in its own good time, I believe that we open in our own good time. I believe that the things that trouble us the most want to move, want to be processed. Life is movement. Life is process. Life is unfolding. Life is unfolding and decay. It's change. And nothing stays the same. Because nothing stays the same, it takes work to keep certain things fixated or frozen so they don't doesn't change. If you're angry, it takes work to keep the anger going for decades and years or months or whatever. It takes a lot of effort to stay angry, full of resentment. Someone recently told me, kind of, it's a lot of work to be sad. No, it's exhausting to be sad. It was a surprise to this person, I suppose, because maybe the person that took sadness as just being something that's kind of, you know, if you're sad, you're sad. But if you stay sad for a long time, it often takes work. It takes kind of repeating certain thoughts, certain ideas, certain attachments, certain resistances have to be in place to kind of keep it up over time. I love it that the word emotion literally means motion, to move out. The E of emotion means out, to move out. Emotions want to be in process. Our whole life wants to be in some kind of process of movement, just like the water that flows. And where we suffer the most, I believe, is when we stand and resist the motion. We stand and resist change, whatever direction the change is going. And so the way to change in accord to nature has a lot to do with learning how to work with nature rather than working against nature. We all know, I think we create a tremendous amount of destruction in the world when we work against nature. And ultimately, we ourselves are nature. We're not different than nature. So even external ways when we kind of damage the environment, we're also damaging ourselves. But to work with nature, how do we work with nature? You know, many of you maybe don't know that I studied agriculture in college. That was my degree, was in agronomy. And so I spent time on farms and it was really beautiful, very insightful to see the difference between farmers who worked with nature as opposed to those who ignored nature and just poured on the chemicals. Back when I was studying in the mid-70s, the Amish farmers had gotten into the news big time because it was kind of the energy crisis time, and the cost of fuel and gasoline and diesel for the tractors and the fertilizers and the chemicals, pesticides, the cost was going up dramatically, and it's never been very lucrative to be a farmer anyway. And so a lot of the commercial farmers were struggling, but the Amish farmers, they hadn't used gasoline or diesel or fertilizers or chemicals forever. They never used them at all. They hadn't noticed it was an energy crisis, and their farms were thriving. Even before that, their farms were extremely productive, and they were just doing quite well. And so then the university agricultural scientists went to kind of studied the Amish. What are they doing right here? And mostly what they were doing right was they were working with nature. They kind of understood their farms really well and saw what it took to work with it. But to work with nature, you have to really study it. You have to get to know it better. And the better you can know it, the better you can work with it. And the same thing is true with our nature, our inner nature for ourselves. The more we study it, the more we get to know it, the more we can learn how to work with it. And there's a lot of ways in which we work against it. We work against it by being judgmental, by being hostile to ourselves, or feeling that we're bad or something's wrong with us. We work against it by demanding a change. I'm really amazed that the number of advertisements that appear, that I hear on the radio or whatever, mostly the radio, maybe it's on television too. It must be on television too. Maybe they don't dare say it on television. We have to see something. But you deserve it is the theme of the advertisement, and they actually say it. You deserve. Why did you deserve anything? I think it's a kind of imposition, of I demand. This is the way it should be. I think the sense of I deserve and you deserve and I demand, this is the way it should be, is partly a symptom of our alienation from nature. I think people who are more closely in touch with nature don't have the sense that nature has to conform to my demands right now. But now we're alienated with nature, and we live in an environment where human beings are the main supporters for our life, creating our life how it has to be right now. And because it's our friends, our human beings who are supporting our life, we can have this idea that, well, human beings are different than nature, and I'm going to demand that my telephone service gets repaired today, or that the buses are on time, or the trains are on time, or we have all these demands. Some of you who might have visited India, for example, would learn very quickly how much suffering is involved in demanding that the train should be on time. And there's this wonderful more relaxed mode that many people take when they visit India, when they realize that they can't assume that things, they can't demand that things be just the way they want them to be, or they expect them to be, or the way they're used to they are, in a culture in America where things buses basically run on time, and basically the telephone service people will come relatively fast. You know, I mean, relatively. I mean, in some cultures you have to wait 6 months before they'll come and install your phone or do something. In America, they come, you know, and you know, it might take a day or two. I don't know. So the point I'm trying to make is that we often, in our culture, because things are so easy and come so quickly to us, and things are so orderly, there's often, I think that ties into this notion, I deserve, I demand, things should happen right now. And the sense of our interdependence, sense of gratitude, sense of appreciation, sense that we're all part of nature, and in nature, the sense of demand isn't our personal little egotistical demands. Just our minute little entities in this huge cosmos. Go backpacking in the Sierras for a couple of weeks and start demanding things. You realize how silly it is, you know. I demand that it doesn't rain tomorrow. You know, what good does that do? So how do we relate to this change, wanting to change ourselves? Is it demand? How do we relate to our nature? Do we have demands on it, expectations on it? Do we impose all kinds of judgments on it? You know, if you look at nature, outside nature, see, nature doesn't judge itself. You can have the most gnarled tree in the world, and the tree doesn't sit there scratching its head saying, you know, what a terrible tree I am. But for some reason, human beings have this wonderful quirk of nature that in our ability, wonderful ability, this wonderful tool we have to abstract and to think, to have ideas, differentiate between things, to create concepts, we then have the ability to use those against ourselves. The idea is we're supposed to have concepts and ideation and cunning in our mind so we can get by better in the world and be happier and be more successful. But we have this wonderful way in which it gets turned back on ourselves. And the very tools that we were given to be more successful, we use those tools to measure ourselves as being terrible people or awful people, or we get the idea that it's not safe to be vulnerable, it's not safe, it's not a good thing to feel suffering or pain. And so we create all these resistance and walls. And those walls that we create in our hearts are going against the flow of nature. So, what is our relationship to wanting change? Is it to be in a, do we want to change ourselves in a way that's in accord with nature, or do we want to change ourselves in a way that goes against nature? And in order to discover that, I think we have to do the study. We have to investigate what is nature, what is actually going on here. What is actually happening? Do we allow change to happen? Or do we impose the change? And what I'm suggesting is that in a spiritual life, a lot of the freedom, a lot of the ease, a lot of the possibility of new realms of existence that are possible are almost our birthright. They occur when we allow them to occur, when we allow the unfolding to happen much more than when we impose a change on our life. So what are some of the helpful ways in which we can help be in accord with nature as we try to change ourselves? One of the most important that I know, one of the most useful I know, is the mindfulness of the body, being in our body. After all, our body itself is nature. It's our closest, most intimate experience of nature that we maybe have is our own bodies. Our bodies are nature, is nature. And so by studying our body, getting in touch with our body, we're getting in touch with nature. And in getting in touch with our embodied nature, we can start asking ourselves, what is it that wants to move here? What is it that wants to be expressed out of this body, out of here? It's for some reason, the volitional drives, desires, fears, emotions of a human being, all reside in their embodied body, in their body. And so to begin feeling the body and asking our body, what wants to be expressed in this body? What wants to come out of this body? What is this body feeling? What does this body want? And to ask it of the body, ask it of nature, as opposed to, and learning the difference between asking that of our nature as opposed to asking that of our mind. You know, if you ask naively someone who's been watching a lot of commercials, what do you most want? Well, what I want is what I deserve. I deserve an Audi. Doesn't everybody deserve an Audi? That's what the guy says on the radio. You know, of course, everybody should have an Audi. You know, so that's what I most want. I most want an Audi. You know, I don't think that's really, that's being in touch with this world of, a superficial world of concepts, of ideas that are often imported from society and people around us and have to do with whatever, you know. Have to do often with our ego. Well, I want an Audi because then people think I'm cool. But to ask really deeply, what is it I most want? What does the body most want? What does nature most want? Maybe in relationship to wanting an Audi, what the body most wants, it wants to be loved, or it wants to love. And for some misplaced idea, I've associated being loved by people by having an Audi. Only if I have an Audi will people really love me. Right? Probably, right? So often there's misplaced ways in which genuine deep desires or movements or desires for expression inside of us get misplaced in funny ways and then get submerged and lost. I can get completely concerned about my Audi and lose touch with what I really want is I want love and I want to feel this openness, this vulnerability. So to drop down into the body and ask, what does the body want? What does our nature want deep inside? And the beauty about that is that if we can find in our body, find in the body what the body wants to express, is that it's often a matter of getting out of the way for that to occur. It's as if we have in the resources within our own body the ability to fulfill what the body wants. And I'm just sitting here talking about all this, and I'm a little bit sensitive to Chloe that's sitting here with us. I apologize to bring you up just like that. And I'm aware of, you know, Chloe's this wonderful dance choreographer, and she spent her career expressing her body, finding out what the I shouldn't speak for you, Chloe, but you know, being in touch with what her body wants to do, and then finding expression for it, letting it come out of you. Isn't that right? And, you know, probably Chloe should be giving this talk rather than me today. But I just felt like I wanted to honor what Chloe does. I felt a little bit that some of you know how to do this already, to find expression. It's a matter of finding what wants expression, finding what the desire is. And to a great degree, our body itself has the resources to provide what it wants, to an amazing degree. Probably to a much greater degree than you realize. Because many of us are looking outside of ourselves. We want something outside of ourselves to provide and do for us, you know, what we want it to do. But really, there are tremendous resources for reside within us. So to give expression, to give expression maybe is the wrong expression, but to allow for expression, to get out of the way for expression. And there's one, which is a footnote to this talk. One of the, maybe because I was thinking, I just thought of Chloe now. One of the traps, perhaps, or one of the stuck places, or one of the misconceptions that people who do a lot of meditation can get into is that the stillness is the be-all and end-all of everything. That you just, you know, just be still all the time. And that there isn't some place for movement and expressive movement. And I've known some people who meditated who never, never danced or never moved or just always relied on sitting still. Maybe you can do that. Maybe if you're really good at it, you learn that sitting still is not sitting still. That everything unfolds and everything moves in the field of stillness. But there certainly is a place for moving also. So is it in accord? Are we in accord with nature? And our body itself is the closest, most intimate place to study nature and discover ourselves and ask ourselves, you know, what is it that wants to be expressed? What is it that wants to move? What is it that stands in the way of movement? What is it that can happen? How can I get more out of the way? And this notion lends itself, supports the idea of tremendous patience and acceptance as we do a spiritual practice, as we sit and meditate. Because it supports the notion that you don't actually know, perhaps, how you're supposed to unfold, how your flowers are supposed to open up in your spiritual life. We sit and we don't really know. Some people sit to meditate and they demand. I've heard that's supposed to get concentrated. That's what's supposed to happen when you meditate. And I demand to get concentrated. I'm going to try to get concentrated. If I don't get concentrated, I'm going to judge myself negatively and bad. We don't necessarily know always what's supposed to happen as we sit. And maybe you're not supposed to get concentrated. Maybe you're supposed to be, maybe you're supposed to end up being compassionate for your distracted mind. Maybe that's the most important thing that's supposed to happen, not getting concentrated. It's hard to know what the lessons, what the movement, what really needs to happen. So of course we try to sit and be mindful, but we're not really trying. I think it's best not to try to instill change or try to know how you're supposed to change. It's best not to think that the way you're supposed to change is supposed to be exactly like the person next to you, how they're changing. I don't think there is any, you know, hard and fast rule. There's only what's true for your nature. And your nature has its own form. And the idea is to be sensitive and be mindful to see and discover what is it that wants to be expressed and moved through you. What is it inside of you that gets in the way? What is the fear, the inhibitions? What is the ego demands that get in the way of of nature moving through you? And then discovering what that is. Jack Kornfield is writing a book on... what he's done is he's interviewed a whole bunch of people who've had some kind of profound spiritual life of all kinds of, in all its various flavors. And then tries to kind of draw some lessons about how spiritual life unfolds for people. And one of his conclusions is that everyone who matures deeply or in a spiritual life becomes unique. That each person becomes unique. They don't look similar to each other. They all become kind of odd, in other words. I don't know if he didn't say odd, but unique is a better word. Because each of us is unique. Each of us is our unique being. And I think what spirituality allows us to kind of stand out is, in part, we don't stand in the way of ourselves anymore. And so our uniqueness can stand out more fully. And maybe there are other qualities that come out also. But each of us are, I think I'm very odd. We're all kind of odd, I think. And if we're not willing to be odd, you know, we're in trouble. You know, if we think we have to be perfect, and you know, we're in trouble. So we're all odd. We all have our own personal limitations, And it's a matter of recognizing that and then finding our own uniqueness, our own self, through that, rather than trying to fit ourselves into some kind of mold of how we're supposed to be, some idea of who we're supposed to be. So I encourage each of you to discover your own nature, and I would hope that you would maybe learn how to accord with nature and your own nature, and to understand that to be in accord with your nature and to be in touch with your nature is very different than imposing your ego on nature. There's a huge difference between the two, and if you can really see the difference between the two, between imposing your concepts and your ideas as opposed to allowing things to surface, you'll be a lot happier and a lot freer. To accord with nature and to discover that you are nature, and in doing that, become freer and more allowing of yourself to be unique, to be yourself, more fully yourself. So that's my thoughts for today, to be in accord with nature. And as I said this morning, there's a saying in Buddhism attributed to the Buddha. Those who practice the Dharma are protected by the Dharma. Another way of saying it, those who practice nature are protected by nature. Those who live in accord with nature are protected by nature. Those who live in accord, those who practice the truth are then protected by the truth. So may all of you be protected by your nature. So any comments or anything anyone would like to add or questions you'd like to ask? Yes, Meryl.
I'm really aware of the aging process, and I'm finding it really interesting watching my friends and how we're all aging differently. And, you know, some of us get really wrinkled and others still have this beautiful, fresh-looking skin. And some of us can't walk very far. It's really, really interesting. And I'm really having trouble just letting me be, you know, and accepting the way I get to look and what I can't do and can do.
So the very practice I'm talking about exists in that very issue.
Right.
And I mean, part of nature is decay. And if you're gonna try to prevent decay, you're gonna have to spend a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of money.
And a lot of pain.
And a lot of pain. And ultimately, it's not going to work. There's a lot of beauty that shines through people who are willing to let nature take its course and not to be so concerned about these things, and to learn to live with the limitation. Life will always present us with limitation. And I think a lot of really honest spirituality occurs in meeting the limitations rather than trying to overcome them. So in noticing how different ways your friends age, you notice some who are more in accord with nature and some are in open rebellion.
I have one friend who's trying to be so saintly. It's really, really interesting, and I'm watching it, you know, and then she tells me how much she's hurt somebody, and it's like I kind of see her imposing this
saintly
on herself.
Someone else? Insulin what?
Imposed something in order for his body to work, which It's interesting, and I know exactly what you mean, but it's interesting to think of what maybe I can.
Well, I think I have a friend who has a kidney transplant, and everybody wants him to have a kidney transplant, you know, and he wants to have one, and he had one, and it's certainly imposing something on nature, because the natural process is his kidneys failed and he would have died. So, you know, I think it's a good thing, perhaps, to some degree. It's a complicated analysis, but, you know, basically, in a gut level, it seems just right that the person had a kidney transplant. But I would like that person to study his body more and study what he eats and what he does and what he does with his stress level, because it seems sometimes that he's putting more strain on his one remaining kidney than is necessary. There's a kind of because he has a new kidney, he feels like, well, medicine will take care of all my issues, and I don't have to anymore pay attention to myself. So there can be maybe this is what you're pointing to. There can be extreme reliance on intervention, and there can be a complete avoidance of it too, which maybe isn't the appropriate way either. So remember that, you know, the idea isn't to remain a child who's just completely free and expresses everything, you know, freely, you know, but rather is from someone who allows our nature to flow freely and learns from that, and then can use our power of discriminating understanding or sensitivity or ideas wisely, as in accord with nature rather than against nature. And it's, you know, it gets complicated analysis, but you know, if I didn't do that, if I went around like this all the time, I wouldn't have, you know, they wouldn't give me a driver's license. I wouldn't have made it here today. You wouldn't be listening to me. You know, there's a place for, I you know, there's a place for, you know, imposing some change. But you know, there's doing it wisely. Yes.
How does this relate to the necessary discipline in order to do spiritual practice that we have to kind of impose on our normal inclinations?
There's a concept in Buddhism called skillful means. And one of the meanings of skillful means is we try to understand ourselves as we are. So it's understanding you know, what's happening with us, this mindfulness of who we are. And then deciding based on that, based on our limitations, based on our hang-ups, based on our tendencies or whatever, what are the means, that are most useful for us to help us in our lives? So it's really understanding ourselves and working with ourselves rather than kind of doing it blindly and kind of imposing something on us. So one person might decide that they see that they never get around to sitting because they say they're really lazy, and so, or whatever, I don't know. And so one person might decide that what's really necessary is a skillful means, given my nature, to really have a really firm commitment and really stick to that commitment no matter what. Another person can decide to do that, to notice that they don't sit regularly. Say, well, no, actually, to impose some firm discipline on me is actually doesn't have much integrity to it. It's actually imposing some will and some tightness, some control, that it seems unnatural to me. And I think that's not the way to sit regularly. I think what I need to do is listen even more deeply inside myself and find out, what is my heart's deepest wish? What's the deepest form of expression? What do I most want? And then to really discover what I most want, then maybe out of that, with my heart's deepest wish, comes a natural inspiration and motivation to start sitting every day. And the fact that the person wasn't sitting every day was a symptom of not going deeply inside oneself to the roots of one's own inspiration. So different people might, you know, have different skillful means. So some people might take iron discipline, and that's the just right for them. And for other people, iron discipline is absolutely the wrong thing. And so skillful means is the principle that we each have to find. We have to know ourselves well enough to know what we really need When we have the principle of skillful means, as I've defined it, the trap in it is that often that little tricky little guy up here in the thoughts and the abstraction, the ego, will say, well, I know what's best. I know what I need. I need a vacation in Hawaii. That's what I really need. Or, if I had an Audi, then I could really sit well. I'm so distracted, I keep sitting and meditating, I keep thinking about Audi.